Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to the KRFY Morning Show. This is Garden Life, a monthly feature of the Morning Show, and my name is Julie Perchinski, here with Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Hey, good morning, Julie. Good to see you.
Here always we are
good
again.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Yeah, so happy that spring has arrived and we're in this great weather.
Oh, my gosh. This is going to be a fun program talking all about gardening.
It sure is, and we're finally in the garden season. We go through a pretty long winter coming up with garden topics and not really gardening quite yet. So it's
That's nice, right, that
we're in it now. We're in it to win it.
That's right, and spring is hard to hold back.
It
is. But finally, I think we can. The weather should be in our favor, and I think we can get going.
Go plan on it. Have you been watching Mount Baldy, and do you still go by that?
I don't.
No.
I got a little thermometer, so I've moved past Mount Baldy.
The Mount Baldy. So, listeners, most of you would know this, but it's been a long, long tradition that gardeners can look up at Mount Baldy, and when the snow is gone, you're pretty safe to put out your more tender plants.
That's right. Maybe that'll be part of our phenology?
Phenology
program.
Yes. Which will be coming, listeners.
Yes, we're looking forward to that one as well.
Yet.
But today, also in the studio, we have guests, Jennifer Jensen and Kendall Call, both from the University of Idaho Extension Service. And welcome to both you gals this morning.
Yes, good morning. And just a quick note on this week's weather. It's pretty uniform, so I'll be very quick. But it's, for the most part, mostly sunny, highs in the middle 70s and lows in the middle 40s. So frost-free week, it looks like.
Looks like it. And a little bit of rain possibly Wednesday,
yes.
I saw.
I hope
that'll come to pass.
And the soils are warming up. And with that,
let's start talking about soils.
Yes.
Our show today is called Soils, Worms, Moths, and More. And the more is because the more I learn about gardening, the more I realize I don't know. So let me introduce our guests a little more. I have Jennifer Jensen, Bonner County Extension University of Idaho educator on sustainable farms, horticultural, and nursery crops with expertise in cultivating success and master gardener program training. So you are an educator, Jennifer.
Yes, I am. Our extension office offers classes for the general public, and a lot of them do focus on gardening or small farm production.
Well, that's great. So it's available to anybody in the area. They can go to you and have their questions answered.
Exactly, yes.
That's great. That's great. And we have Kendall Call. She is an assistant professor and extension specialist in soils with expertise in sustainable organic agriculture, soil ecosystem functionings, and earthworm ecology. Kendall, this is something different with the extension offices to have organic information. Is that true, or has that been happening for a while?
This is a new position that the university created about a year ago.
Okay.
It's not unique to extension in general. There's organic farming-focused extension specialists in other states associated with other land-grant universities, but it's new to the U of I, though other researchers at the U of I have been doing organic research just as part of a broader program.
That's great. I know traditionally the extension offices didn't really go into organic as much, and I think that's a really great evolution.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yes, a lot of organic growers in the area can really use your expertise.
Yeah, I'm excited to be working with them.
Good. And we really need your expertise today because we're going to talk about soils. So it's the 4+ years I've hosted Garden Life with Julie, we've discovered so many different approaches to gardening, but maybe the most dramatic is the different approaches to soil and soil health. So after 20 years of gardening in my garden, I realized my yields were reducing and thought, I should probably have a soil test. I've never done that. And had my first one last year, and I tried to read it and called my guy, Jim, and said, what does it mean? And he tried to tell me, and I sort of understood, and he told me what to do. But now I've had my second year of tests, and I've sent it to you. So let's get down and dirty with what is happening in soils and how to understand these tests. And I guess we'll begin with why. Why is it important to understand your soils? Kendall, maybe you take that one as the soil expert.
Sure. Soils are the foundation to all of our terrestrial ecosystems, right? So they're important to our forests or any type of prairie or grassland, but also to food production, right? We wouldn't have these plants, we wouldn't have these edible crops and everything else that goes with that without our soils. So I'd say they're important to all of us. They're a fascinating ecosystem that we just walk over and don't necessarily think about. So I think it's fun to take a moment and think about what's happening below our feet.
In just about every gardening book you pick up, that's the first thing they say is there's this whole world under our feet that we're not even aware of. And understanding it would help us in every part of our lives, for sure. So what kind of soils do we have in the area? What would you say if someone came to you, Jennifer, and asked, what kind of soils do we have? How should I start?
Well, to be honest, our soils vary quite a bit throughout Bonner County. So really, it's hard to pinpoint one particular type of soil. However, many of the soils do tend to be a silt loam type of soil. So when we think about those particles that are in our soil, we distinguish them based on their size. And silt would be that middle size of particle. And so we have those primarily in our soils. Of course, there's sand, which is the larger particles, and clay as well. But many of our soils are classified as a silt loam when you look at their textures.
Silt being the finest of the particles.
Silt is actually the middle.
Okay.
But they are small particles, much smaller than sand. Clay would be the finest.
Okay.
Okay. And I would like to just back up a second and ask, like, what is your basic underground soil comprised of? It's minerals, right? But it also has organic material and living creatures. What is the definition of a soil? It's not just the silt and the sand and the clay. So help me with that.
Sure, yes. So we have these mineral particles, which make up about maybe 45 or more percent of the volume of the soil. And then as far as other particles, we do have organic matter. So that could be that extra 5% there, or it may be less or more, depending on your soils and maybe what you've been amending with your soils. And then the other half of that volume is made up of air and water. And that's going to fluctuate based on our weather, irrigation, whether, you know, you might have 25% air, 25% water, but of course that's going to fluctuate.
That was not where I saw this going.
I'm thinking air and water, were you, Julie?
Well, I did a little research. Oh, so it is air and water. And that, we'll get into that too, because the composition of the soil determines how much air and water it'll hold.
Right. A sandy soil may have more pore spaces in it, so it could have more air pockets in it.
And less water, because the water does not want to stay in the sandy soil.
Exactly. When you have those larger pores, it can just drain right through. But a more clay soil is going to have smaller pore space, and it could, with the silt or the clay, might become more compacted, especially as you're walking on it or if there's equipment running on it. And then that also reduces the amount of pore space and hence the amount of air or water that could be in there.
I was also kind of amazed when you said that the organic material is as little as like 5%. I know it can be more, but it seems like that's such a tiny amount for the organic material.
Yes, but that's that can be pretty normal. Mm-hmm. Native soil is probably going to have less, maybe 1 to 3% or so.
right? Not a lot of compost in native soil until a volcano blows. Would you call that compost, or is that more of a mineral?
Yeah, that's actually the volcanic material is a mineral. And that's, our soils up here are very unique because we have a lot of silt-sized particles that are actually from volcanic material in origin. And that material in particular just has a lot of unique properties. So it makes our soils function a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. They have the andic soils is what we call them. They a soil that has volcanic ash influence, but the volcanic materials have really high surface area. They're tiny, tiny particles, but really high surface area, which just makes them have different properties. They can hold on to nutrients and water really tightly because of that. One of the unique things about soil and that I think a lot of people don't think about is that there's actually a lot of charge imbalances that happen within soil, and that's what sort of holds nutrients and also allows them to be released and is sort of the magic that makes soils this interchangeable and continuously fluctuating situation.
Is biochar considered like a volcanic type of a mineral addition? Because that's also blackened.
Right. I think I don't know that I would consider it volcanic, but it's similar in that it also is a small particle with high surface area. So again, it can hold a lot of nutrients. Sometimes it can bind them so tightly that it makes them unavailable. Both the ash particles and biochar, but also creates just a lot of surface area that can hold a lot of nutrients and exchange them.
That charging of those materials is pretty important before you put those in the soil as well, somehow to get them to release things, or how are they charged?
Yeah, it's just...
Or is that too deep in the rabbit hole?
No, I mean, it's just a chemical property of that particle. So it just is that way, I suppose. And then you can, with biochar, you can sort of saturate it with nutrients. That's something that is done, sort of mix it with the fertilizer before adding it. Maybe that's what you're thinking.
Yes, it is. I made the first mistake I made. Well, I've made so many, but that's how I learn about gardening, it seems, is to put biochar on dry. And then as I was reading about it, I realized I should have charged it before I put it on because it needed to have something to hold, I guess.
Yeah, when it's really dry, it actually almost repels water.
Right.
Right. So you want to that's more of just hydrating it. Right?
Okay.
So you want to saturate it, and then it'll make it more acceptable to holding more water once it's in your garden. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Boy.
But great question.
So many things to talk about. So let's go back to that silty loam soil. What would be the first thing you would tell someone who came in with traditional soil to the extension office? What is the first thing you would tell them to do to add anyway?
Well, to be honest, we often tell folks the best thing you can do is probably start with a soil test to know what's there before you start adding any amendments or nutrients to it.
That's the other mistake I made. I always thought the more compost, the better. And so this report I get back is like, too much compost, too much compost. So I got to back off on all my compost because it takes up too much of the percentage of the test. That was interesting.
Well, didn't you learn that you had too much nitrogen in your soil?
Well, there's another story.
Was that a difference?
There's another story.
Okay.
So I can't even compare my 2 years because this year I had a soil probe. And that's something that he told me, I have to have a soil probe and go down 6 inches. Don't, you know, all around the garden, but 6 inches, put a line on it. And he's very scientific because last year I just took it off the top. So my nitrogen looked so high last year because it was right off the top. But this year it came way down.
Oh, you tested off the very top.
Yes, I tested it off the very top last year. Just took a scoop. You know, didn't know any better, and he told me get a probe and do it that way.
And that is something that we have at our extension office, a soil probe for taking these samples. And we do loan that out to anybody that would like to borrow it.
That's great, because it sounds very important.
It is, to be able to sample down to the depths where the roots are growing.
Exactly.
And also taking multiple subsamples from the area that you want tested, so that you're not just accidentally having an anomaly because you just took it from one particular area of the garden.
And then when one does take from numerous areas, you don't mix it together, do you test, or do you mix them together?
You would mix that together to get an overall picture of the garden. If you had areas of your garden that you were managing very differently, or if you knew that the soil type looked very different in one area compared to the other, then you would probably want to test those separately.
Them. Understood.
That makes sense. And I guess that pretty much leads us into, let's talk a little bit about the organic matter, and especially about worms. Kendall, I know that you're the worm expert. Let's talk about organic matter.
Does your card say Kendall, worm expert?
No, but I wish it did.
That can be your logo, a little worm. Tell us a little bit about compost and worm compost and the best kinds of compost and how not to use too much compost.
Right. Well, let's see. Starting with compost, there's a lot of different types. And we apply compost, one, for adding organic matter. For just the general organic matter and carbon addition, which carbon provides the food for a food source for all the organisms in your soil. And organic matter also works as sort of the glue within the soil. It really helps create that nice mixture of solid materials to air and water to allow the soil to function like an ecosystem. So it's important to the habitat, I guess, within your soil, but it also can supply a lot of nutrients. But it's going to supply those nutrients in an organic form. Most plants take up nutrients in an inorganic form, and so they need to be further sort of processed to convert them from organic to inorganic, or sometimes we call that those plant-available nutrients. And so our organisms help convert those nutrients from organic to plant-available. And worms in our soil are a key part of that, just because they're big and they move a lot of material, and they're sort of the earlier side of the decomposition process. And then our smaller organisms, all of our microbes and such, they help further break down that material into those truly plant-available forms. So compost is a great way of supplying nutrients, and we think of it as sort of a slow-release type of nutrient, because they have to be sort of processed additionally after you add that material. And then you can also use worms to help make compost, right? That's a specific type of compost that's just been sort of additionally processed. So it can be more fertile, and it can just be, it can have sort of higher, more readily available nutrients in it.
It's really good.
It is
what we're saying.
It's a great product.
Yeah. And so worm compost, it's caseins. Mm-hmm. And that's the byproduct from a worm from breaking down all that organic material, and it becomes inorganic then, and then it becomes available?
It's still in a, there's a mix of inorganic.
Okay.
And you can see that in your compost test. They break it down by your organic and your inorganic nutrients, so you can see there's a little bit of both, but the majority of your nutrients are still in that organic form. They're just sort of pre-processed is the way of thinking of it. So they're one step closer to being fully broken down.
Right, available.
Mm-hmm.
You talked of, before we go there, would you consider cover crops an organic matter material?
Yeah, they're a great way of getting organic matter into your system, into your soil. One is, right, you grow a cover crop to leave all that plant material in your soil, either on top or mixed in. And plants are going to also, they release, we call them root exudates, and they're just organic-based materials just through their general functioning. So they bring in a lot of carbon, a cover crop will bring in a lot of carbon to your soil. And also just the action of those roots growing in is good for building and breaking up if you need to. Compact to soil, but also just sort of building a good structure and, of the soil.
Right. And keeping a cover on the soil too, which is important.
Right, right. The soil surface can be very fragile. And if you think of most of our sort of native ecosystems, most of them aren't bare, right? Most of them have some sort, either that sort of duffy leaf litter material in a forest or and if you imagine a prairie, there's always some sort of plant residue on the surface sort of protecting that. And so we want to try, the more we can emulate that in our garden, sort of the better for that soil ecosystem.
Yeah, and for so many reasons. So it can stay moisture, it's not blowing away, like just tons of reasons
yes.
why it makes sense to have your soil covered.
Definitely. You can see the damage it causes, you know, with the drying and the cracking and it just looks tough.
Yeah.
Real
and
rough.
Water runs off if
right.
we don't have it covered.
That's right.
All those things.
So is the let's talk about the nutrients. Let's talk about the NPK. Jennifer, maybe explain that to us and how we can use that.
Sure. So in general, the NPK, we're talking about nitrogen, phosphorus, the P, and potassium is the K. Nitrogen is generally used for leafy shoot growth of the plants. And so that's kind of that above ground portion. The phosphorus is generally used a little bit more for some root production and also potentially flowering for the plants. And then the potassium is used in the plant to help with water intake. As well as production of other enzymes in the plant. Sometimes it's used for cold hardiness to help the plant move into that cold hardy acclimated state for the winter as well.
That's interesting and something I didn't remember
right.
knowing it.
Right. That's I always thought cool. of it vitality, you know, the vitality of the plant is that K part.
K potassium. Yes.
Right. Is that in the organic matter or is that in the soil itself?
Both.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So it could be broken down in the soil, as Kendall mentioned, in that more available state for the plants or in that more organic form still.
And, you know, so many listeners are home gardeners and they're, you know, going to be producing, I don't know, huge zucchinis and this and that. So I didn't hear one of those elements being a key to getting your vegetable production. Is it all three together in the right balance? What makes for great veggies?
Yeah, it's having all of them in sort of roughly the right balance. If you end up with too much nitrogen, you know it because
yes.
your plants grow really big and really dark green, but they don't end up putting on any fruit. And
that's right.
often because of either, just the too much nitrogen or a lack of phosphorus.
Ah.
And we focus on these three so much, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, because they're what we call our macronutrients, because plants need them in the highest quantities. But there's, you know, around 10 or so other what we call micronutrients, or which are also essential to plant growth, but plants just need them in a lot smaller quantity. And with a healthy soil, you just generally have them present in that environment, and we don't typically need to add them.
The minor nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say it's a complete, like a 5-5-5 or 6-6-6, or is it more nitrogen? A lot of the vegetable is a little bit more nitrogen, a little bit less phosphorus, and then also less potassium. Is that generally what you, or you just can't say because it's, you got to have the soil test.
It does really help yes. to have the soil test. And some of our vegetables are going to have different requirements
oh, sure.
as well. So sure. some of our vegetables we are just growing for the leafy content, like our leafy greens, mm-hmm. for instance, as opposed to those tomatoes or squashes where the goal is to have the fruit.
Okay, that's a good point. Oh, let's move into pH then. That's another part of the test is the pH. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so pH is a measure of the level of acidity or alkalinity of your soil. So if it's acidic, it has a low pH. If it's alkaline, it has a high pH. Most plants grow best in a soil pH range that's right around neutral, which is 7. So I typically think anywhere from 6, 6.5 to 7.5 is where you want to be for most vegetable crops and or most of our garden plants in general. Some of the classic exceptions are blueberries. Mm-hmm. Blueberries like an acidic soil. And the reason why plants like this specific range is because pH is going to control nutrient availability. And again, it comes back to that charge that I was talking about in the soil. pH is literally a measurement of the hydrogen ions in your soil, which probably doesn't mean much to most folks. But a hydrogen ion is a positively charged ion. So it's changing. So you can think of pH as changing that charge, or you can almost think of it like the magnetic capacity of your soil to hold nutrients is maybe an easy way to think about it.
Back to the blueberries or those acid-loving plants for a second. You just mentioned that a soil pH of somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5 is good in general. Will an acid-loving plant want even higher than like a 7.5? Or
so an acidic-loving plant would like a lower
pH. Yes, sorry, I have that.
No,
this
yeah.
is why we asked the question.
Yes, I know. It's very, yes. it's very. Yes. You have to be a scientist
if you don't. Yeah. If you're not thinking about it, yeah,
every
yeah.
day,
every right. day, right? Then, yeah, right. It's, right, exactly. So yeah, you want it. Jennifer may know this better, but I think of blueberries wanting the soil to be down closer to 5.
Oh yeah, quite a bit,
or even yes. lower.
Yes, 4.5 to 5.5. Mm-hmm. For many of them, actually was just doing a little bit of reading. There are some cultivars that can handle a higher pH up to maybe 6. But most of our cultivars of blueberries prefer 4.5 to 5.5.
Okay, so that would take a little effort in yes. many of our gardens to yes. make sure they are happy.
Is it all berries? Like raspberries? Let's talk about raspberries. Are they also an acid-loving plant? No, not as much.
No, not as much as the blueberries.
Well, I've been putting pine needles on my raspberry for years. Okay, but maybe that's okay.
Well, and to change that soil pH, you know, some things like the pine needles, a lot would have to be added, and it takes okay. a very long time for that to okay. break down. So it's probably not going to change that pH very significantly.
But a nice mulch, you got your soil yes. covered. Yes. That's good.
I'm learning so much. Okay, how would, say, on my test, it's 6.8 is my pH, which was a 5-star. He was happy about that. But how would I bring that down to 5.5 if I wanted to grow blueberries in a certain area? What would I do?
Probably adding some sort of sulfur.
Okay.
You can purchase like an elemental sulfur product that can be mixed into the soil
okay.
to lower it.
Okay. Just, and then you will only know if you've reached it if you do another soil test, I assume.
Yes. And it can take some time mm-hmm. for that to break down and change that pH.
Okay.
So sometimes you wouldn't necessarily see the effects for several months or a year even.
Yeah, and one way to speed that up, which is a little bit more labor intensive, is to actually dig up some of that soil and mix in something like peat moss or something that just is more acidic. And just plant your blueberry directly into that more acidic material. Because it can take a while to get the pH to lower and to get it to stay there.
Right. So a lot of the soils do have to be replaced. You know, people build a box or whatever, and if they're going to put blueberries in a box, that would be a great way to start.
Right. And just a question about mosses. I'm assuming all mosses are not created equal. I can't take like the moss out of my shady part of the yard and expect it to be acidic. It's not really peat moss.
Right. No, the peat moss is like a particular material you'd probably have from like a peat bog, essentially. So yes. You'd want to buy it. Yeah.
So it's not any old moss, listeners.
Right. Yeah. Great point. Yes. Great point to clarify.
And lime is a sweetener as well.
Lime will raise your pH.
That'll raise your pH. So there we go.
It's basic, right?
Yeah.
It's
right.
Basic.
That's right. Exactly.
Would I want to go higher than 6.8, or is that, you're happy with that?
No, okay. I think you're right in that sweet zone.
There's an area we're going to give you a pat on the back, Julie. You got it going.
I got one thing right.
That's good.
How do you get soils to hold water? Is there, I know we talked about organic, the compost. Are there any other ways to get it to hold water and coverage, keeping the soil covered? What else? Any other ideas?
A lot of the soil's capacity to hold water is going to be based on just the material was there, that was there. You kind of get what you get. You can increase it by adding organic matter. That is sort of the classic and easiest way to try to increase the water holding capacity. Having a good soil structure also helps. So doing things like growing a cover crop or not over tilling a soil so that you sort of build that nice structure and balance between the particles and air spaces and pore spaces is important. And doing things like keeping the soil covered so that water can sort of infiltrate and doesn't just run off. So you just getting the water to enter the soil sometimes can be is the first step, right?
Right.
But really adding organic matter is the easiest way as a gardener, certainly, to try to increase the water holding capacity.
I think your point of not over-tilling needs to be emphasized, because that completely destroys the structure and you can't get any air in or any water in if it's all fine little pieces.
Yeah, I think there's a balance. You know, we've definitely learned that tilling can cause problems, but tilling can be a useful tool, certainly. Mm-hmm. Can help you mix in a compost or an organic material, but trying to do it not more than once a year or even doing it once every few years and letting that soil and that ecosystem sort of rebuild is important.
Because of all the living organisms in the soil.
Right.
Right.
And they're resilient, right? And so especially if you're adding organic matter, providing food, providing sort of good habitat for them, they can sort of rebuild pretty quickly. But every time you come through with the tiller, you're knocking them back.
So. Yes. My sister had a neighbor who just tilled and tilled and tilled this poor, poor garden area. I think he went through like maybe 5-6 times. It was crazy. And I don't know what he grew, but he only grew 1 year and that was the end of that. I think he ruined his soil. What about the air? I guess that's kind of the same as what we're talking about, is just keeping it fluffy. They talk about keeping it fluffy.
Yeah, having that soil that has the ability for the roots to penetrate and move through easily is going to be important. The roots of the plants do need oxygen. So we want that airspace for those roots to obtain oxygen as well.
Is that why raised beds are a better idea than the flat growing, because you aren't walking along the roots? Or
Potentially, but oftentimes a raised bed, especially if your native soil is particularly compacted or has rock or is just shallow, then the raised beds can really help provide a better growing space. Mm-hmm. But a other in-ground garden can certainly be managed in such a way that you're not constantly walking where the roots are growing, and can also function very well.
Okay. Yeah, lots of ways to do that, to just establish your footpaths where you know you're going to walk and you're not stepping in the areas where your plants are. It's totally doable.
Originally, when I first raised my beds, I thought maybe it would dry it out more earlier, warm it up earlier. Is that correct with raised beds?
That can help, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yes, by having that soil above ground, it does tend to warm up more quickly in the springtime. If you've got an area, we do see in our, in Bonner County, certain areas that in the spring, they get rather waterlogged. And so having a raised bed can help alleviate that and get the area ready to be planted a little bit sooner.
I think in town, there's a lot of clay because of the fill, because, we are sand point. They had to bring fill into, and my garden was all clay when I started. I couldn't get a shovel in to save my life. And actually, about 18 inches down, I still can't get a shovel in. Mm. So I had to kind of build on top of that. But it's worked out well. I have a viable garden now.
And there's a term for that impenetrable clay below our soils, isn't there? What are we calling that? I'm
trying to hard remember. Pan.
Is that just the term hard pan?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and it's very much a fact around here. You'll dig down and hit that, won't you? Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the bugs, bugs in the soil and also outside, above the soil, and how to keep them healthy with either organic growing or care with spraying or not tilling. Kendall, what ideas do you have to just keep your garden critters healthy?
Yeah, growing a lot of different types of plants is a great way to do that. Various insects and organisms have, sometimes they have relationships with specific types of plants, or also just different plants are going to provide and bring in and have different interactions with nutrients. So having that diversity is nice. And again, not overly disturbing your soil, right, is helpful to the organisms that live underground. And then having flowering, we always think of, right, having flowering plants and plants that flower throughout the year so that your pollinators and other above ground insects have that food source sort of throughout the whole summer.
Mm-hmm. And if we're doing a good job of encouraging our beneficial organisms, does that also in any way benefit the, are there non-beneficial organisms is what I guess I'm trying to ask. And is there a way for us to keep an eye out for them and try and promote the good ones and not have bad ones? Or are they just all good?
Unfortunately, they're not all good. There are some pest insects, both above and below ground in the soils. But the majority of the insects are either beneficial or just not going to harm our plants. So I think that's important to remember.
Think about, yes.
Don't just assume when you see an insect that it's going to be a harmful one for your garden.
Uh-huh. But below ground, I think gardeners have at least most have some understanding of the bugs we don't want on our plants above ground. But is there anything below ground that if we notice it, we should act or not really?
Cutworm.
Right.
Yeah, that's one.
There's a few that at least have some phase of their life below ground that can be challenging. I think of a lot of the below ground pests, though, as being small enough that you can't really see them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not that they can't be problematic, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of the eggs are in the ground, so that kind of is the place they hatch.
Sure.
Right. And I think Jennifer was saying this too, but there's a lot of good insects and bugs out there. And so the idea of having all the diversity, right, helps keep them in balance so you don't end up with too many of the problematic ones. doesn't always work out that way. And there are interventions. There are sprays that can be used in other ways to try to control them when you do get a pest problem.
How would you know if you had an underground tiny little microorganism that was harming your garden? How would we look for that or know about it?
Sometimes you see above ground symptoms from the plant. So if they are feeding on the root system above ground, you might start to see wilting, or maybe it may look like a yellowing or some other nutrient deficiency because those roots aren't functioning as they should be. So that could be one clue that something's happening with the root system underground.
This takes us right into Jennifer's project this year with the coddling moth?
Correct.
Yes. Tell us a little about that, what you're working on.
We're working on monitoring for coddling moth so that we can get a better idea of when the appropriate time to spray or control for that particular pest in our apple trees. Primarily is. So we have some of our Master Gardener volunteers that have traps with a lure in their apple trees. It will attract the adults of the moth. And so the first generation of adults will be emerging pretty soon. We have not seen them in our traps yet.
Okay.
Last year when we did this, it was about mid-May when we saw our first adult. And then from there, based on when we see the first adult, and then combining that information with our weather pattern by tracking what we call our growing degree days, we can then determine when it is they're going to be laying eggs and often, you know, when that second generation may come, which often it's the second generation that's most damaging for our apple crops.
Sure. Is... at the organic orchard, will they have it listed when they're going to be spraying? Like Kyle has told us through the years, he's had different sites where he kind of tells people, okay, I'm going to spray for this now. Is that still a go at the organic orchard?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, because I thought that was a great service for the whole town, is just to find out when you should be spraying to be effective, because then you don't have to keep spraying through the summer. You can spray it when you're going to stop them.
Yes. There is another site that's managed by the University of Idaho Extension called the PNW Pest Alert. And on that site, it's something for the whole state of Idaho, but they have alerts specifically for North Idaho when it is that certain pest insects or even sometimes some of the diseases are most prevalent and you should be out controlling them at that particular time.
Great. Don't have to wait to see it then.
Correct. No.
Kind of.
All right. Well, guys, I'm just going to circle back. If you've joined us during this hour, listeners, this is KRFY, listener-supported community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. This is the Garden Life show that comes on one time per month, and our host is Julie Perchinsky. This morning we're being joined by Extension. Are you both Extension? Yes, Jennifer and Jennifer and Kendall. And it's Jennifer, you're Jennifer Jensen and Kendall Call. Both smartest ladies in the county or close to it, helping us understand soils this morning. And I'd like to circle back because I can't believe it. We've used 45 minutes and we haven't circled back yet. But if people are wanting soil tests, remind them again, how would they do that? Where would they go?
Well, as we mentioned, they can borrow a soil probe from the Extension office to take their sample. We do have some information at our office with some different labs. There's some soil bags, but you can also use just a Ziploc bag. And there's several labs that provide good information for soil tests, one of them being the University of Idaho. They do have a lab on campus in Moscow that you can send your sample off to. And we're actually working right now on creating a better test result form that is maybe a little bit more easier for gardeners to understand.
Julie was commenting on that before we began the program. Even for you, it's a little complex, and you've been a gardener for a long time.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's all science.
Yeah.
And I mean, and I say this too all the time. I'm a soil scientist trained. I think about this all the time, and I still have to, any new test, I have to spend some time looking at it because they are really detailed, and yes, there's a lot of nuances to it. One of the benefits, we hope, to be the outcome of trying to improve our system with our U of I lab is just simplifying some of that, so that one of the other benefits of using the U of I lab will be the support you could get from your local extension educator, like, yes, Jennifer, where she's well acquainted with that test and knows how to interpret those results, the measurements, and the methods that they use at that lab. So we're hoping to just make it sort of a quicker, easier, more user-friendly system.
Very nice. And so the process, if a listener was like, okay, today I'm going to go out and test my soil and see what I've got going on before I start my garden, if you haven't started, first step could be come to the extension, borrow the soil probe, get your test from various areas, if it's kind of all the same soil, mix it together, and then mail it to whichever testing company you're wanting to send it to. Yes, and then it'll come back. And how long might one expect for that to take?
Maybe about 2 weeks.
Okay, so we better get going, folks. And then the next step would be you'd return your borrowed soil probe, hopefully within less than 2 weeks, and then come back in, and Jennifer, you could help interpret.
Yes, interpret. I'm always welcome to help interpret, regardless of what lab that you end up using.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
That's great. And finally, is there anything else you'd like to announce that's happening at the Extension office, or any classes or any other events?
Well, just this afternoon, actually, I'm going to be having a class on hugel culture gardening. It will be held out at the Priest River Library at 1 o'clock. This afternoon.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with hugel culture, it's kind of a wild way of gardening. Give us a quickie explanation of it.
Yes. Yeah, so it's basically where you're creating sort of a raised bed, a mounded bed, and you have woody material in the base of it. And then you're building on with smaller and smaller material, finishing with topsoil and compost on top then. And then the idea is, as that's breaking down, it's help holding more moisture in that garden space there. And so it can be a good way to start a garden.
Yes. And it can look pretty wild. It looks like kind of like you went to the dump and came back with a bunch of stuff. And yet there it is, growing veggies.
It does start off that way. Yes. Hopefully you've got a nice soil cover to it.
There you go.
And you do want to keep something growing on it or have a mulch on it, because again, you don't want that to just wash off or erode away.
Right. How much soil would you have on top of that woody material? Or is it a layer? You're going big, smaller, little?
Yes, there's many layers to it. That final layer of soil, you'd probably want about 6 inches.
Okay, so. Well, that sounds very doable.
Kendall?
Yeah, we have an example of a hugel culture bed at the Sandpoint Organic Agriculture Center in our vegetable garden.
Neat.
And we're going to have our second, I guess, farm and research tour out there this summer. So if folks are interested, that could be a great time to come see it and learn about some of the other things that we've got going out out there.
Great. And do you have any idea what month or an approximate time frame?
We haven't. It's something I needed to get with Jennifer about at some point here, but probably later July.
All right.
General time frame, but we'll make sure to get that out soon.
Let's finish with your contact information. Give us your real quick information. And gosh, we are running out of time.
Where did this hour go?
I know.
We're about done.
So our extension office is up by the fairgrounds on North Boyer, 4205 North Boyer. And you can call us at 208-263-8511 or email Bonner@uidaho.edu.
Yes.
Okay. Either way, that sounds great. And what are your hours, business hours?
We're open from 8:30 to 4:30.
Monday
through Friday.
Okay, correct. That's a lot of hours. That's great.
Yeah, and I'm based out at the St. Point Organic Agriculture Center, which is just a little bit further up North Boyer Road.
Right. And SOAC, S-O-A-C, if yep. you're looking for it online.
Right.
And would folks be able to reach out to you, Kendall?
Yep. You can reach me at 208-885-7505, or my email is kcahl, so that's K-K-A-H-L, at uidaho.edu.
Okay, very good. And does the Organic Center, you don't have regular hours for the public, do you?
We don't have standard hours that we're open, but we are open to for a lot of different events throughout the year.
Absolutely.
I do have to ask one thing before we go. Has the big composting thing, is it working?
Yeah, it's happening. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Right.
Well, tell us just briefly what that is. The listeners might know what not know what big composting
oh
thing
my gosh,
means.
It's right. a big composting thing.
We got a it's called an Earthflow composting unit. It looks kind of like, it's basically a shipping container with a big auger in it that allows us to make pretty high volume of compost, and that was in partnership with the Kootenai tribe. So we've just in the last few months made our first batch of compost. And that's
for your own gardens there, I suppose.
We'll be initially experimenting with it and mm-hmm. using it at the farm, but we hope to produce enough to make that available to
the
other folks.
Public. And the big idea behind this is that it's a replicable technique using containers. Is that part of the inspiration or not so much?
Part of the inspiration for this was more from the food waste management. Ah. This is more large scale and automated than most people would want to do on a smaller scale. But it was to, improve our waste management mm-hmm. At the community scale, and then also provide a local organic compost.
Right. So, but for large scale producers of food waste, it could be something that could go other places than just the U of I. So it could maybe become something other folks could use.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The idea, the big idea.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, gals. It's been great talking to you, and it wasn't as painful as I thought it was going to be. I was very nervous, but I think we really kind of took the cap off it and can understand it a little bit more.
I do,
Thank you so much for coming in.
And I don't think she sounded nervous. Sounded pretty confident, Julie.
Well, I had that dream, remember?
Oh, true. All right. Well, once again, we're going to close up another one of our really fun and informational Garden Life programs. Thank you, Julie Perchinsky. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jennifer and Kendall. You're doing such great work for the community and helping all of our gardeners. It's so nice to know that you're there to help us learn. Appreciate it. And I think we'll go off to a song break. And then, as I understand it, we've got some more live programming coming.
Yes, Jack will be in to talk about the 7B Live Gives with the Senior Center.
Very
so
good.
So he'll be in momentarily.
All right. Well, listeners, thank you for joining us this morning, and have yourselves a great day.
Bye-bye now.